Case number 14-1112 et al. Henry Murray Energy Corporation Petitioner. Case number 14-1146, State of West Virginia et al. Petitioners versus Environmental Protection Agency. Mr. Lynn for Petitioner Intervenor States. Mr. Barnes for Petitioner Murray Energy Corporation. Mr. Tribe for Petitioner Intervenor Peabody Energy Corp. et al. Mr. Link and Ms. Berman for Respondent EPA. Ms. Costello for Respondent Intervenor States. And Mr. Donahue for Respondent Intervenors NGOs.
All right, Mr. Lynn, good morning. Before we start, first, we'd like to thank the council for accommodating our changed oral argument schedule. And just so we're all on the same sheet of music, the order is going to be jurisdiction, merits, as I understand it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Albert Lynn, Solicitor General for the State of West Virginia. As Justice Henderson just said, I want to confirm, I'm up here today to address all the non-merits issues for all three cases. Then Mr. Barnes and Professor Tribe will speak to the statutory and constitutional questions that go to the merits of all three cases. And I've reserved 6 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Your Honors, there are three equally appropriate vehicles before this court to provide relief in this highly unusual case: the request for a writ, the petition for review, and the challenge to the settlement agreement, which I will address in that order, if I may. First, the writ. Three reasons together put this case comfortably within this court's and the Supreme Court's cases.
Do you know of any case in which we have halted a proposed rulemaking?
I do not, Your Honor.
Why do you think that might be? I mean, in a rulemaking, there is a provision for judicial review, right? It's not going to be a question that's avoided. We're going to get to this, right? When the rule comes out, it'll be challenged. We're going to get to it. Why in the world would we resort to an extraordinary writ, which we have never used before? So it really is quite unusual.
Of course, Your Honor, it is highly unusual, and we acknowledge that. Of course, in any situation where a writ has been granted, especially where there's the possibility for appeal, that's the very idea of the All Writs Act. As the Supreme Court has said, it provides this court the ability to issue a writ in cases over which it will have appellate jurisdiction. And we think there are three.
Well, it's to preserve our jurisdiction and to make certain that there aren't issues that evade our review otherwise. What's the issue that would evade our review here? This is a garden variety in that sense. Rulemaking, we do this all the time.
Well, Your Honor, I think the words "in aid of jurisdiction" have not been interpreted by the Supreme Court or definitively by this court only to apply to situations to protect this court's jurisdiction. I think what the Supreme Court has said is review under the All Writs Act is in the nature of an appellate review. But even if this court were to, say, use the language from the telecommunications case when interpreting "in aid of" as to protect the jurisdiction, I think one of the issues here is that there are remedies that this court cannot provide in the future. And that gets to one of the three reasons, which is that there are ongoing harms that cannot be adequately remedied. And they're both to all the petitioners, both to industry, but especially to the states.
Once again, any case in which bracing for the cost of a proposed regulation we found there's Article III standing there. You know of any case in which we've said you're bracing for what's coming down the pike, therefore it's standing?
Well, Your Honor, I think there's a difference between the bracing for the cost, which may be more in the vein of what the private industry is doing, but it's not just bracing. They're making decisions that they have to make because these utilities make decisions on a 5, 10, 15-year horizon. But more importantly, what we have here that is unusual, because it doesn't come up very much, is a situation where what the rule does is it makes the states become the primary regulators. And you have before you declarations from 8 experienced state regulators.
But you still have the fact that all we have in front of us is a proposed rule. You have proposed rulemaking. Nothing is final yet. We don't know what the final rule is going to look like. I mean, I imagine we can guess, and the administrator hasn't been very helpful to the government's argument in this case with her statements. I guess we could guess what the final rule would look like, but I don't think that we're typically not in the business of guessing what a final rule will look like. We typically wait till we have a final rule, till the legal terrain has changed, till we know what the issues actually will be.
Well, Your Honor, that gets to the three reasons because I think the three reasons do address that. And the first is that what we have here is the highly unusual circumstance of an agency that is using the cover of a proposed rulemaking to avoid judicial review, where, in fact, it has made up its mind on the one issue that we're talking about here.
And how do we know that? From the administrative statements? Or?
We know that both from the administrative statements, but also from the statements in the rule and from the statement that she made when they announced the rule.
But aren't there plenty of instances in which an agency announces a proposed rule, is a dogged advocate for that in public, and yet as a result of notice and comment, they amend the rule. They change the rule. Sometimes they may abandon the rule altogether. That's not uncommon, isn't it?
Well, we're not familiar with another situation where they have made statements of the definitive nature about the legal authority that they have made in the preamble to the rule. If you compare the statements about...
So your rule would have us analyze, would review proposed rules based on what? Based on statements of the agency head that she thinks the proposed rule will look like the final rule? Is that the terrain you want to pull us into?
Well, again,
those are going to be tough calls for us to make.
They are, but writs of prohibition cases are always tough calls, and that's why it's a case-by-case standard. And again, I think there are three factors here, not just the first, three reasons. And the first is this, where there are definitive statements about this particular issue, the Section 112 exclusion, and if you compare those statements in the preamble to the other statements about the other legal questions, what is the best system of emissions reduction, whether the best system of emissions reduction will be applied statewide, all of those are stated in terms of this is what EPA is proposing.
What are your second and third?
The second is the ongoing harms that are especially being incurred by the states that cannot be adequately addressed. And the third is that this is an absolute prohibition. This gets to Judge Griffith's question. The one issue that is here before this court, it does not matter. If we are right, it does not matter what else happens here, because there is no rule of any kind that can be issued under 111D to regulate existing power plants because there is a Section 112 rule. And I think this falls, I mean, there are a number of cases both in this court and in the Supreme Court that are relevant here. There are cases where both this court and the Supreme Court have granted review a writ where there has been a misbehaving agency, and we're talking about, or a misbehaving inferior court. It's the Colonial Times case where there's about taking a deposition without a stenographer.
Yeah, but none in which the proposed rulemaking was halted. None.
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. But that's the whole idea of an extraordinary writ is that there will be an extraordinary circumstance. And I think it would be a remarkable...
But it's not that extraordinary. I understand this is an important rulemaking, but there are other important rulemakings we face over time. And yet the absence of precedent indicates that the formality of the actual final rule being promulgated is the dividing line between judicial review and waiting.
Well, I think that's true.
And that's true even though there are lots of cases where you, in essence, know what's coming.
Of course, Your Honor. And I think that is true in the ordinary course, and I don't think we'd dispute that. I mean, our position is that we don't think we'd ever see a situation where there are these three unique circumstances again, in particular, the first one, because if this court issues a writ here and says one of the reasons is that the agency is using a proposed rulemaking to evade judicial review when it has in fact made up its mind that it will issue a rule, that is something an agency can adapt to. They will not do this kind of a thing again. We won't see this again. And secondly, I think the other reason that this is highly unusual, which we've talked about, but I think it's worth emphasizing, is this is a case involving where the federal government saying that the states are going to be the primary regulators, and where the administrator said on day one, states need to begin preparing. And that's not something that you're going to see a lot either. I mean, there are cooperative federalism regimes out there, but there are not, as compared to the universe of rules situations where you have states that must begin preparing now, both because of the statement of the administrator and the finality that's clear from the rule that there will be a rule.
It does seem like there are lots of rulemakings we confront or proposed rulemakings that end up in final rules where people do have to start planning, if they're prudent, ahead of time. And I'm having trouble seeing how that factor here would distinguish this from, as Judge Griffith says, a lot of other cases where we would suddenly be put in this morass of trying to figure out, are the statements enough to kind of make this obvious what's coming down the pike? I'm having trouble seeing the line.
Sure, and I think, again, I think there's an important distinction between, while there are very significant harms to the industry petitioners, there are going to be stranded investments and important issues there. I understand Your Honor's concern that maybe that comes up in a lot of cases. But here we have states.
Right. There are, as you acknowledge, there are lots of programs, cooperative federalism programs, of course, and lots of areas outside the environmental area where the states are heavily involved in the federal program. And it does seem like the states often have to prepare, too, for what they know is coming but is not quite yet finalized.
Well,
I'm wrong about that, but I think there are a lot of programs where the states are heavily involved and they have to get ready, so to speak.
Well, I don't think we've ever seen a program that's like this, and that's why the 8 uncontested declarations are important. We have 8 experienced state regulators who have between them an average of 2 decades of experience each, and they all say to the person, they have never seen a rule like this, one that, as the administrator herself has said, attempts to regulate from plant to plug. I mean, this is about fundamentally reordering the way that energy is provided within our borders. And each one of these regulators says...
But maybe the final rule will change some. And I know you don't think that's a possibility, but the whole point of having a comment period, even when you're adamant at the beginning, is maybe you'll tweak it. Maybe you'll change your mind entirely. Sometimes people do that. Sometimes courts do that. They change their mind based on arguments and reconsider things. And for us to get in the middle of this before that's happened seems highly unusual and would preclude the whole process that is designed to lead to a reasoned final result.
Of course, that is, again, the usual.
And you're arguing that there's this unusual combination of factors that would make this sort of a one-off. I'm not so certain. If we were to do that, which we've never done before, if we were to do that, it would invite lots of other challenges before a rule is finalized. And then where are we? What are the judicially manageable standards we use to determine, short of the final rule, when a challenge is justiciable? I think it's a real problem. You're inviting us into a morass.
Well, I think this court and the Supreme Court and other courts have always faced that question in writ cases. The Colonial Times case and the Schlegelhoff case, I mean, both of those had to do with district court discovery orders relating to how to take a deposition. And, you know, lines were drawn and floodgates weren't opened. You know, the Trapp case has certainly not overwhelmed this court's docket. I mean, in the ordinary course, if a petition for writ is filed and there's nothing there, this court doesn't even call for a response and dismisses it in a fairly short order. And again, I mean, I think what we have here is, while in the usual case, you may have, you know, minds that are changed. I mean, what the states are faced with, and what our regulators have said, again, in these uncontested declarations, is that we're faced what we know now. And what we know now is we're facing a rule of an unprecedented scope, requiring actions that
Mr.
are...
The legal memorandum itself and the preamble, they invite comment. Now, is your argument that that's just a sham, that they've made up their mind and they're not interested in that the comment period is just a complete sham? That must be your argument.
On this particular issue, we do not think that their mind is actually open. We think their mind is made up, contrary to the
Because
APA.
Of the administrator's statements, right?
Both because of the, again, the contrast between how they describe their conclusions on the Section 112 exclusion and how they describe their conclusions.
Where? In the legal memorandum?
In the preamble and in the legal memorandum.
But what I'm saying is But both of those invite comment. They say, we've taken this position, now please comment on it. Now, you're, again, if that, if you're going to invite us into those sorts of disputes, I don't see a limit on it.
Well, I think the limit is, I mean, they can speak in terms of proposals. I mean, they were able to do it here.
But inviting comment after the legal memorandum and the preamble, that's not good enough for you?
Well, not here. I mean, what they had was the definitive conclusions versus the proposals. And then while they did invite comment generally, you know, the distinction was confirmed by the statements that the administrator made both at the time that it was issued and
repeatedly. I grant you, the statements of the administrator do not help the government's argument at all. I grant you that.
I think I see this differently from my colleagues. I see a closed mind as far as the legal issue, and unless you line up every environmental lawyer in this country to make comments about this is legal, it's not legal, they've already stated their position on the legality of it. And that's not going to change with comments. I mean, the only thing that's going to change it is a court telling them, no, you're wrong on the law.
That's right, Your Honor.
Can I ask you about 7607E?
Of course.
That's the provision that says no other judicial review can be recognized in this case. But what about the writ as far as that? Is it your position that the relief by writ is excluded from that prohibition?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the way we would look at this is that the writ 7607D, which provides that this court will ultimately have exclusive jurisdiction over this kind of a rule, is what provides jurisdiction here. This court has the ability, in aid of its jurisdiction, to issue all writs that are necessary and appropriate.
All right. And as I read not only our precedent, but the Supreme Court, our jurisdiction only has to be potential or future to issue extraordinary writ. That's what in aid of jurisdiction, I think, is alluding to. In other words, if for some reason, Judge Roberts said, if the appeal hasn't been perfected or for some reason it's simply potential, yes, we have the authority to issue a writ.
Yes, Your Honor. I think you're referring to the evaporative milk case, Roach.
Well, this is in Ray Tennant.
Okay. There's that. There's FTC versus Dean, which says the same thing.
Right.
The only times that the Supreme Court of the United States has spoken about the innate of language, that is what they have said. And this court, while it has said to protect jurisdiction in track, it also said in a later case, GTE, that track is, of course, relates only to a narrow class of writs that can be issued under the All Writs Act.
And as far as the costs and so forth that are going on now, I just read the affidavit that discussed the little sunflower rural utility that it's going to take between 18 months and four years for them to prepare if this thing goes through. That's an extraordinary type of cost right now.
That's right, Your Honor. That's a very good declaration that sets forth the harms and the decisions that need to be made by industry and by the utilities. As Mr. Penrod points out in that declaration, they not only have to make decisions about what they're doing going forward because of contracts and things of that nature, they also have to plan in advance, as much as 7 years, when they're going to have shutdowns. And if they don't start taking that into account now, they'll have unplanned shutdowns, and they have all kinds of other, there's a whole regulatory morass with respect to their requirement to be able to provide energy. But even beyond the writ, we think there are the other two vehicles, the petition for review, which turns on a lot of what we talked about already, as far as the statements in the preamble and in the legal memorandum being final as to the Section 112 exclusion, but not as to the others. And then there's also the challenge to the settlement agreement.
How do you get around
on that, right?
Yeah.
You had to challenge that within 60 days,
yeah.
The settlement agreement.
We don't think so, Your Honor. As we explained, we think we fall within the after-arising ripeness clause of Section 307D. And that's because at the time When the settlement agreement was finalized and finally announced, noticed in the Federal Register in April of 2012, it was not ripe at that time. And I think maybe one way to think about it is if you had, say, two parties that entered into a contract to do something, and Congress passed a law that, or even the state passed a law that made the object of that contract illegal, I mean, would the challenge be ripe at that time, or would the challenge be ripe when one of the parties attempted to do what it was obligated
but
to do?
It's interesting that you say in your brief, your reply brief, it wasn't clear in April 2012 that EPA intended to abide by the Section 111D portion of the settlement, in essence saying maybe EPA would change its mind.
At the time, yes. And now I think in June of 2014, what we have is not only have they gone ahead, but they've gone ahead in spectacular fashion by making very clear, both in the preamble itself and in repeated statements by the administrator since then, even as recently as Tuesday of this week in Chicago.
Wouldn't the safer thing have been to assume that EPA was going to abide by the Section 111D portion of the settlement? You went with a hope for the best approach in not filing within 60 days of that, I guess.
Well, we would have had to litigate the question of ripeness at that time, and I think we're...
No doubt, and that's, I understand the confusion in the ripeness case law, but there is the 60-day requirement. What about standing on that? We have a case that says challenges to settlement agreements, the Defenders of Wildlife case. How do you deal with that case?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's obviously Judge Henderson's decision. We think that there's a fairly clear distinction, which is the difference in the timing. What happened in the Defenders of Wildlife case, the challenge was brought at the time that the consent decree was being entered into and approved by the court. The only question there was whether the consent decree itself could cause harm sufficient for standing. What we have is not an issue of the challenged action directly causing harm, but something more like the Tazi case that we discussed, where it's an indirect harm by the challenge agency action. As this court has said, you know, the question there is there harm, and then is that harm traceable? And so I think that's a very different situation than what was going on.
Are any of the states party to the settlement agreement on the petitioner's side of this case?
Any of the? No, they are not.
All right. So where is the standing, let's say, for West Virginia to challenge a settlement agreement that it's not a party to?
Well, some of the cases that they've cited from the Seventh Circuit, they talk about how there generally is not standing for a third party to a settlement agreement. But what we have here is a situation where, again, we are harmed by something that has happened as a result of the settlement agreement. And we are, in fact, the object of the settlement agreement, which is to promulgate this regulation that is directly about the states. And so I think we're dealing with a very different situation. But Judge Henderson, and I see my time has expired.
Go ahead.
But I think it's an observation that you made is important, which is, no, they are not on the petitioner's side, but the states are here who are parties, and they're on the other side, and they clearly think that settlement agreement is imposing binding obligations. Otherwise, they wouldn't be here. I mean, why are they here to defend settlement agreement if not for that, them and the environmental group interveners? With that, unless this court has any further questions, Mr. Barnes will turn to the merits.
All right.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Jeffrey Barnes, a counsel for Petitioner Murray Energy, and I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal, which I will cede to co-counsel. Your Honor, the key merits question in this case is whether EPA can regulate power plants under Section 111D when they are already regulated under Section 112. Congress answered this question and said no. Section 111D prohibits EPA from regulating under 111D any air pollutant emitted from a source category which is regulated under Section 112.
But now this is where the case really is an unusual case, right? I mean, is that what Congress said?
Well, I believe, and certainly if you look at EPA's positions until this litigation,
No, but let's look at where do we look to? Do we look to the statutes at large? Do we look to the U.S. Code?
Well,
we've got if we look to the statutes at large, and there's some precedent that says we do, we've got two conflicting provisions.
Well, there really is no conflict. we believe, under in the statutes at large. EPA has attempted...
Do you agree that's where we ought to be looking, is the statutes at large?
Well, the statutes at large are prima facie evidence of the law, and that obviously can be, it seems to me, viewed two ways. It's either presumptively valid, okay, or, but the decision that was made by the office charged with the responsibility of correcting the types of Scrivener's error that we see in this case.
How is this a Scrivener's error?
Well, the
you
way
have,
in
you
which...
You have the House passing a version of the law and then Senate passing a contrary version. Is that... That's not a Scrivener's error. A Scrivener's error is a mistake that a Scrivener writes in recording something. There's no mistake here. There are no typographical errors in this. You have two conflicting provisions.
Well, if you really look at the sequence of this and how it evolved, looking at referencing now the provisions as stated in the statutes at large, you know, the House, again, it's not the ultimate version that was passed, the law that was passed, these were two different versions that were sort of competing at the time. Section 108G was a substantive change. Okay. It amended 111D by striking Section 112B1A, which was the list of hazardous air pollutants exempted from 111D regulation.
The bill that the president signed had a provision in it that said you can regulate and had a provision in it that said you can't regulate. That's we're dealing with a conflicting statute, right? Shouldn't we be looking to case law that tells us what to do with a conflicting statute rather than case law that talks about a Scrivener's error?
But if you look at the way in which the two provisions operate, you could give effect to either one and you would end up at the same result. And arguably...
How's that on the side?
Well, for example, under Section 302A, okay, which was designed
if
to...
If you had just the Senate amendment.
Yes. If you had just the Senate amendment, that would...
You'd have a problem.
No, because it depends if you first give effect to 302A, then you simply change, shift it to 112B instead of 112B1A. And then Section 108 would delete 112, would delete 112B. So conversely, if you first give effect to Section 108G, okay, that would eliminate 112B1A. And then as the Law Revision Council properly concluded, there's nothing for 302A to amend. In fact, interestingly,
and I imagine everyone at home is following that, right?
That's well, my apologies, and I should apologize to my colleagues who had to go through the process of looking for similar examples. And of these Scrivener's, we would view Scrivener's amendments that were obviously in error. In fact, interestingly...
But here's the problem. If we don't think it was a Scrivener's error, if we think it's a conflict, right? We've got two conflicting statutes. If we disagree with your reading of it, here's your problem. We can count five votes on the Supreme Court in the, and I don't know how to pronounce it, the Ciabatta case, that tell us what to do if it's a conflicting statute. And they say, those five votes, I may not agree with them, but they say, this is a Chevron case. That's how, and when Congress passes conflicting statutes, we let the agency decide. So that's why you need to miss that box, right? You need to get out of that box, and you need to be with Scrivener's error. I understand.
Yeah, but in the Schiavola case, it was really a very different situation. There, you really had an internal contradiction in the statute, and frankly, if there were a conflict or a problem, you would defer to the Office of Law Revision Council and not to EPA.
Why?
as my...
I'm not sure I understand that. Why would you defer to that office?
Well, there is no, to my knowledge, no case law dealing with deference to that office, but this was the office set up to resolve this type of error in the type of statute we have here. As my co-counsel, Professor Tribe, will discuss in more detail, if you delegate to EPA, or if EPA takes, as they're attempting to do here, the task of deciding what the law is, okay, that raises some significant constitutional issues.
I understand your argument on that, but I guess I was just questioning why you would defer necessarily to the office.
Well, not necessarily. Mm-hmm. All I was doing is contrasting the notion of deference to EPA in this case, which we believe to be completely inappropriate and wrong.
And I'm not saying the statute's like this, but hypothetically, if a statute authorizes an agency, one provision of a statute or an amendment authorizes an agency to do X, but not Y, and another provision, another amendment authorizes the agency to do X and Y, Is there a conflict, or is the agency just authorized to do X and Y?
Well, it depends in part on, again, in the context. In this case, interestingly, EPA's own brief, footnote 23 at their page 48, where they went through and dismissed the various examples, similar examples, of how the Office of Law Revision Council does its job properly. They acknowledged that one of the examples that we raised, in fact, would be clearly an error, that is to say, obviously an error. And it was a very similar situation in which we had one bill, two amendments. The first amendment deleted the text, and the second altered the text. And in that case, and again, EPA's own brief acknowledges that when you have that kind of a situation, it is appropriately, obviously an error, and there it is appropriate for the government to, or for the Office of Law Revision Council to do what they did in this case. Okay. In fact, it's similar to the Bank of Oregon case where you had, sort of clear evidence of an unreasonable omission. It simply failed to execute because the Section 302A simply had nothing to refer to at that point. Now, EPA has made a variety of additional arguments where they now, for the first time in this litigation, claim that the text of the code is also somehow ambiguous. Okay? That has never been their position before. In fact, they had conceded repeatedly. In fact, even in the legal memorandum in this case, that, quote, a literal reading of the statute would mean that the EPA could not regulate any air pollutant from a source category regulated under Section 112. Okay? They acknowledge, again, the plain reading of this statute. And one of the key points in this case is that the context and structure of the Act, again, which is how we should look at interpreting Section 111D, makes perfect sense, because what we're talking about here are, and it's an important distinction, with existing sources as opposed to new sources. When you have a new source, you can evaluate multiple requirements, fold that into the economic decision, the investment decision, particularly in the utility context, over which you're going to have a known set of requirements. Instead, what EPA is doing here under Section 111D, which was seldom used, applies to existing sources. Okay. That's a very different approach where, after the initial construction is done, you have subsequent requirements being imposed that could completely disrupt. And this is one of the reasons that Section 111D had seldom been used. Okay? Now EPA is attempting to take that provision and expand it, okay, vastly into this new huge regulatory program over carbon, because that is now, you know, the great concern of the day. EPA claims that there's, if they can't do this, there's an enormous gap. Okay, that is not so. First, that's not really the issue. The core question is, what did Congress say? And we believe Congress was clear on this statute, and that, for example, EPA could continue to cover sources not covered by Section 112. New sources under Section 111B can be regulated. Under the AEP versus Connecticut decision recently by the Supreme Court, or the UART decision, that is to say, PSD, that is to say, new source review requirements when an existing source goes through a modification, it can be subjected to additional requirements. EPA could delist under Section 112 if it chose instead to go under Section 111D. There are many different ways that this issue could be addressed, but we believe in this case that the agency has simply taken this one section, 111D, and attempted to create an entire scheme where Congress, we believe very directly in the statute, simply said they could not go. Whatever you may think of the ultimate policy choice on this regulatory scheme, the agency simply shouldn't be able to take a clear statutory prohibition and create an entire new scheme on a provision that simply wasn't designed to do that. This should be a choice by Congress. We've already dealing with the complexities of dealing with carbon under the Clean Air Act. Again, whatever you think of the policy choices, this is simply not available as a vehicle by which the agency should be permitted to proceed.
Before you sit down, Mr. Barnes, I wanted to ask you, what effect, if any, you think the White Stallion case that is now before the Supreme Court, if that Mercury rule is vacated, do you think that has any effect on this case?
I don't believe so. EPA certainly never said that it would in any of the briefing. It's never taken that position. We don't know what the Supreme Court will do. The Supreme Court's decision is dealing with an important but relatively narrow issue of whether costs should be taken into account, okay, in deciding whether regulation under Section 112 is, quote, appropriate and necessary. EPA has clearly said that no matter what happens to the case, they will proceed under this rule to evaluate costs and do the regulations. And in the meantime, the industry is suffering a tremendous harm because of the cloud of uncertainty that has been placed over the entire program. If you look at the...
Are you back on carbon rather than the mercury? I was asking about white stallion.
Oh, the mercury, yes. I got to the wrong pollutant. But on mercury, though... But it's also relevant in the sense that there are many sources which are dealing with that regulation now, right, and they're facing a decision, right, as to whether to continue or shut down.
Right.
And the additional imposition of the uncertainty of this regulation, okay, of having yet another item, it's a bit like the sword of Damocles, which doesn't have to be dropped to have a deterrent effect. As you look at what these utilities have to do in their efforts to comply, in the long-term planning that would be needed, okay, it's having a dramatic adverse effect on the utilities, and in particular, my client.
The rulemaking will be completed in June, isn't that right?
That is certainly what the administrator said.
Yeah.
An ambitious effort, but I see my time is up.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Tribe?
May it please the Court. I think I'd like to begin with a point that Judge Henderson made about the apparently final decision by an apparently closed mind. There are all sorts of details that we don't necessarily know about. But what we do know is that we have an agency that is premising its actions on a view of the law which is not about to change. They keep coming up with different rationales for reading 111D in this way that it hadn't been read for a quarter of a century.
But we will know within 2 months what their final view is, right? I mean, the purpose of notice and comment is to give people a chance to contest it.
And by then, Judge Griffith, it may be too late. That is, we don't know for sure exactly what kind of regulation the EPA would come down with for states that do not succumb to its commandeering. But we may never know, because every state may ultimately decide that it can't afford the risk.
Well, can you give us a rule by which we would decide that a challenge to a proposed rule is ripe?
I'm afraid I can't give you a bright line test.
Okay.
I do think that if you look more broadly outside the rulemaking context, you'll find a number of cases in which the U.S. Supreme Court has decided that one needn't wait to see whether the guillotine is going to drop or which part of the neck it'll cut off. Let me give you a different example. In the Jackson case involving the Lindbergh law, somebody had been indicted but not even tried yet. But what was hanging over his head was a provision that said, if you want to take the death penalty off the table, there's one way to do it. Plead guilty. Don't go for a jury. Now, if he had pleaded guilty, the court said that wouldn't necessarily have been a coerced plea. But the question was, is it permissible to condition what amounts to relief from an unwanted outcome on the waiver of a constitutional right? That was a question that the court had basically decided in Spicer in 1958, and as recently as Agency for International Development in 2013. The principle was, if you are threatening whether an individual or a state with something that that individual or state has a right to resist, like commandeering by the government, and what you're doing is dangling a carrot saying, we'll take that threat away. The carrot is, we will not impose a certain burden on you, a tax or a regulation of a particular kind, as long as you give up your right. That's the moment at which it's crucial for the court to intervene. That's why in Jackson, the court struck the law down.
That does seem like the reasoning that the Supreme Court used in Abbott Labs to allow challenges to rules pre-enforcement rather than forcing parties to wait for enforcement. But this would be, I think, bumping it even further ahead.
And for a reason that's quite extraordinary, because, and I wanted to talk about the constitutional issues, this ongoing process by EPA deviates both vertically and horizontally from the separation and division of powers. And I want to talk specifically about this idea of dueling amendments. This is not a Chevron case. They are really asserting the right to take something that was deliberately receded to by the Senate, and I'll explain that in a moment, and say, well, we're going to resurrect that and toss it into the air along with the bill that was passed by both houses in 1990 and signed by the president, and now say it's up to us to catch either the bill as it has been codified in the U.S. Code for 25 years, or instead to catch something that couldn't even be executed. Now, let me talk about that for a moment before getting to the vertical violation of the constitutional structure, which involves commandeering, which these states cannot avoid unless they say, well, bring it on with your regulations, but they can't afford to gamble on that. So what's happening is that EPA is looking at a substantive prohibition, which was enacted by the Congress, not just the House, by Congress in October of 1990. And although I can go into the reasons for concluding this based on the language of the U.S. Code, it very obviously bars EPA from using 111D to direct states to regulate source categories. That was the whole shift in 1990. Source categories that EPA already regulates under 112. And what they want to do is replace that with what was explicitly called, even in the statutes at large, a conforming amendment. It's a conforming amendment that traces to a vote in the Senate in April of 1990. And what that vote did was to update a cross-reference by deleting all of six characters, four of which were parentheses, and none of which remained to be deleted in the bill. That was the whole problem. They were trying to delete something that didn't appear in the 1990 amendments. And for that reason, in October of 1990, the Senate conferees, this wasn't just some public officer, the Senate conferees receded from that conforming amendment. It was not in any sense a separate version of 111D. When the Law Revision Council concluded that it couldn't be executed because it tried to delete something that wasn't there, that was what I suppose could be called a Scrivener's error, but in any event, it couldn't be done. So you couldn't really reconcile these two provisions, one of which is inoperable. But if you could, that is, if for a moment we imagine the scenario in which you've got a law, just to take Judge Kavanaugh's example, that says X and Y, and what do you do? Well, the first thing you try to do, if X and Y are not wholly consistent, as here they wouldn't be. I mean, X would say you can't regulate the source. You can't regulate any pollutant from a source that you're regulating under 112 by using 111D. The other one, I'm not sure what it would say, but suppose they're right. Suppose it would say it's all in terms of air pollutants. That is, you can't regulate an air pollutant under 111D that you're regulating under 112. What do you do when you have those two commands? You follow them both. They're not inconsistent. I mean, they're drawing a Venn diagram and they're telling you that there's no intersection, and therefore they have to choose between the circles. Well, even if these were two laws, and they're not, the Senate conferees receded, the obvious way, the only constitutional way to reconcile them is to obey them both. And that could be done here. There's no incompatibility. The reason they think there's an incompatibility is they seem to see the structure of 111D is a kind of three different on-ramps to the regulatory road, whereas instead, if you look at the sentence structure, it's three obstacles that you have to overcome. And if you have two laws...
Right. They see it as authorization, and you're describing it as prohibition.
And in fact...
That's a challenging statutory question.
Well, but if you read it, it's obvious that Section 111D tries to create an exemption for 112. Mm-hmm. The way one of their fancy new readings in the brief they filed 2 months ago here would read it, it would be a mandate, not an exemption. That would be completely contrary to what the statute's ordinary meaning is. It seems to me because they read it as three on-ramps rather than three obstacles, they try to create the illusion that there are two different provisions or two different statutes that you have to reconcile. If there were, you could, in fact, obey them both by treating each of the obstacles as decisive. Mm-hmm. But think of it, is Chevron really about the power of an executive agency to say, well, there's this law that's been on the books for a while, and actually, our argument would be a lot easier if we looked at a different law, one that was never actually enacted. It was included in the statutes at large, 107 pages from the operative sections, in a grab bag called Conforming Amendments, which listed six things that were problematic in one way or another. this one problematic because it couldn't be executed.
Professor Traub, do you agree that if we thought they were conflicting statutes, and I realize mm-hmm. you think they're not, if they were conflicting statutes, then the Supreme Court has told us that it is a Chevron case.
Well,
I think that's rather surprising, but that's what they've told us.
Well,
right?
It would be particularly surprising if applied to a context like this. I think to avoid reading the court as having dealt with the case of internal irreconcilable provisions,
right,
as though it applied to a case where the Congress passes a statute and the statute has in it a separate section which says here are some miscellaneous provisions.
So you think it would make a constitutional difference if they were in separate the conflicting provisions were in separate statutes as opposed to the same one?
Depends whether it is an operative section of the statute or not. That is, it's not unusual to have an appendix that says here are some things that were written down in this, you know, vast law that for some reason or another are mistaken. You can't do them. They can't be executed. They ask for something impossible. And if you set them aside to make it clear to an ordinary reader that they're not intended to be operative.
You've changed the hypothetical. The hypothetical I'm giving you is if I disagreed with you on that and saw here two conflicting
absolutely conflicting provisions.
Then it is Chevron right after Seattle.
I would try to look at that decision and read it more narrowly in order to avoid accusing the Supreme Court of not knowing how to read the Constitution, because it seems to me this is a perfect example of lawmaking. I mean, it's not resolving an ambiguity of word. I mean, Chevron, among other things, requires that Congress make a decision to delegate something to an agency. Where in this law is there a decision to delegate to the EPA not the power to set standards, but the power to choose between?
Well, I would agree, even with if I were of the view that there were conflicting provisions, I would agree with your argument there. But I don't think they've given us the room to do that. That's the only.
Well, I think you have the room to do that. In fact, you did it in American Petroleum Institute against SEC. An opinion by Judge Tatel in 2013, where renumbering cross-references in a way that conflicted with a substantive amendment was said by this court to be something that could be disregarded. I mean, talk about finding an elephant in a mouse hole. This mouse hole is a moot, non-executable, inoperative mouse hole that nobody for a quarter century has thought could absolutely erase what Congress was obviously trying to do in 1990.
Well, both amendments were signed by the president, right?
Right. And this was an amendment that might as well have said, because it couldn't be executed. I mean, it's worse than an ink blot. I mean, it's not something that could be done.
It said erase. It's interesting if this was a mistake, which it seems like mm-hmm. it was, that the way to correct it was not to pass a technical amendment or technical corrections bill, which is obviously, as you know, common.
It's common. It's also common because these comments of the reviser are circulated to everyone in Congress, that if anyone in Congress had been troubled, they would have said something.
Now, it's interesting whether that's equivalent to a technical amendment passed by both houses and signed by the president.
But I'm not asking for the kind of deference to the reviser's office that one would in order to raise the question of equivalence. I mean, the reviser here was simply a functionary who was performing a task that a well-programmed computer would have performed. That is, if any provision makes reference to a non-existent part of the statute, do not include it. That would be easy to program. It seems to me, in any event, the idea, the fundamental idea, that for an agency to say, aha, we're going to run with a different statute that can be deemed to have been enacted only by treating a non-executable moot provision as though it were law, would really upturn the entire constitutional system in a way that I think this court should make clear, whatever relief it does or doesn't grant. I think in terms of Judge Henderson's reminder that this agency is going to think it can do that unless this court tells it cannot. That, at a minimum, is something I think this court should make plain.
Well, I think on the merits you've identified at least what the question I have in mind is what to do with the Senate, with the House version.
Well, it seems to me it's
and with the Senate version. What to make of that? And
I hear your argument. What this court did in American Petroleum Institute. Mm-hmm. And that is to say there's a standard practice of disregarding provisions that are inoperable and haven't, for that reason, haven't been included in the U.S. Code. This would not be a unique case. If you were talking about and worried about floodgates, there are dozens of occasions where, despite the possibility of passing a technical amendment, in fact, the way the legislative system has gotten past the presence of provisions that can't be executed and are moot is simply to disregard them. And that's happened dozens of times. I hesitate to think how much of our jurisprudence would be upended if we were to say, well, because this could have been fixed more directly by an exercise of legislative power, we have to live with the absurdity of treating as law something that simply cannot be executed. There is, I think, in addition, a serious problem of the rule of law and separation of powers, even if you set aside that novel attempt to rewrite the law altogether by applying Chevron in a context where I think it doesn't apply. And that is, even if you sweep away this dueling amendments theory and stick with the version of 111D, I'm sorry, I see my red light on it.
Go ahead and finish.
Okay, thanks. If you stick with the version of 111D that has been in the U.S. Code for the past quarter century, the problem arises from Justice Frankfurter's comment, which I think in a dueling way both Judge Kavanaugh and Judge Griffith cited in the Sierra Club case, and that is that there are three main rules of statutory construction. Read the statute, read the statute, read the statute. That's really all you have to do here. You can't read this statute except with a predetermined desire to expand the authority of the EPA into an area that it has not in the past touched.
That sounds familiar.
Well, maybe, but I don't think that one gets the right to do that by adverse possession.
I should have put that in an opinion I wrote.
Well, I do think that they distort the statute beyond recognition. And just as a reality check, 111D, despite some rather interesting history that's present in the preamble to the Clean Power Act, the Clean Power Plan, when it was announced last June, it's never been used to regulate or to order the states to regulate any source category that is already being regulated directly by the EPA under 112. And in fact, even if you go back before 1990, it's been used for only one relatively minor rule since the 1990 amendments, when the Clinton EPA agreed with our understanding of the statute, but concluded that under this understanding of the statute, you could use 111D to regulate landfills. It's never been used to revise the electric power grid or to do anything of the sort that the EPA is trying to do here.
All right. You're over your time. We'll give you
okay.
some time.
Thanks.
Time.
I suppose the main thing I didn't get to was the anti-commandeering problem, which I think is profound. So perhaps
that's
in my rebuttal I can talk about
group.
It.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Ling?
Good morning, Your Honors. Consistent with your order of issues, I'm prepared to address jurisdiction while Ms. Amanda Berman will address the substantive questions. The Clean Air Act's judicial review provisions in Section 7607 reflect Congress's policy judgment that allowing EPA to make the first decision on all issues that arise in notice and comment rulemaking, including questions of statutory authority, is a better alternative for the court, the agency, and the public than piecemeal litigation. Because Section 7607 provides an adequate and exclusive remedy for petitioners challenged to EPA's statutory authority in the form of seeking review of a final promulgated regulation, they are not entitled to the unprecedented relief of using an extraordinary writ to review EPA's proposed rule. We think absolutely that use of the writ under these circumstances would enlarge the court's jurisdiction. It would not simply be an aid of jurisdiction. Petitioners essentially are arguing that one type of challenge to EPA action, a claim that it lacks statutory authority, is so different from all others that the court should review it immediately if any interested person objects to a proposed rule on that ground, while other claims must await a second round of review after EPA promulgates a regulation. But the text of 7607, and specifically 7607D9, makes no distinction between lack of statutory authority and all the other listed grounds for reversing EPA action, including that such action violates the Constitution. The Act requires review of all such claims to occur after EPA promulgates a regulation in response to public comments.
But is there any doubt here that the EPA is going to regulate CO2 emissions from existing plants? Is there any doubt in anyone's mind about that?
The administrator has said she plans to move forward with a final rule. But that is no different than
with a final rule? Is she that vague? With this rule, right?
And if we are talking about the administrator's legal rationale, all we have to go on at this point is her tentative rationale that she published expressly for the purpose of seeking comment.
So it might change.
We don't know what her final legal rationale would say.
She may decide we won't regulate here. That's a possibility.
I would assume that she has meant what she said in statements she's made where she says she's confident she can move forward. But we certainly don't know at this point.
What is the purpose of notice and comment in the face of statements like that? It's a sham, right?
Not at all. And it is not simply a question of whether the agency will change its mind or not. It is also because the statute is designed to ensure that when the agency puts out a proposed rule, it receives input from all of those who have an interest in that subject matter, all of their views, takes those under consideration. The statute requires the agency to respond to all the significant comments, and that ensures that when the court finally reviews the issue, that it's got the full context.
What are we to do with statements that suggest that there will be no change, that the decision's been made, the rule will proceed as has been proposed, in the face of this notice and comment period that's required? What do we make of that?
I would suggest that those circumstances are no different than those in the Perciasepe case, where the consent decree required the agency set a deadline to conduct a rulemaking, and the agency had already been quoted as saying it intended to update the regulations. Those who wanted to intervene thought that those regulations would be more stringent and more costly to them, and that therefore they were injured. And the court held that there was no Article III injury simply stemming from the conduct of the rulemaking process. It's the final rule.
Did we have statements in Perciasepe that were like the administrator's statements here?
I don't know if they were word for word the same, but I know that the claimants there pointed to statements the administrator has made as conclusive of the fact that, well, she's going to adopt ultimately a new rule and it's going to be more stringent. And the court did not regard that as creating an immediately Article III, a case that was right at that time. The court said,
Do you understand my concern? The government has argued to us it's not ripe, it's not timely, because this isn't a final rule yet. We're engaged in this process of notice and comment. Things may change, right? I mean, that's the suggestion. Things may change. And yet we have these statements that are being made by the administrator that suggest, well, no, it doesn't look like anything's going to change. Better get ready.
Well,
do you understand my concerns?
I think that's an over-reading of her statement. She herself has said, I'm confident we will move forward, but the proposal as proposed may not be what we move forward with. She told that to Congress. So again, you know, ultimately here the suggestion has been made that, well, this is just a case about the bare assertion of legal authority. But it's not. If you look at the briefs, what they're really concerned about is the content of the proposed rule, ultimately, in conjunction with the assertion of legal authority. We don't know, though, what a final rule would look like. We don't know what impact it would have on any of the stakeholders. We don't know what the legal construction would
be.
Why
has the EPA told states, get ready, it's coming?
It's no different than any other program. The entire statute, ultimately, is based on rules that the agency adopts but that are largely implemented by states. There is a constant cooperation and communication as the agency moves forward with various rulemakings. It commonly sets a schedule and says, well, we expect that a final action would occur by this date or by the summer or by the winter. But in none of those circumstances has a court ever said, well, we're going to treat that as outcome determinative and simply adopt review now of a proposed rule when the agency has not yet taken a final rulemaking decision. And even if the administrator had reached a point where her thinking on one issue presented in the context of this rule was resolved, that's still not a rulemaking decision. What the Act authorizes review of is the final decision addressing all issues. And it ensures, therefore, that the court reviews those questions at a time when it has the context in which to consider them. We've seen examples in recent cases before this court, such as Coalition for Responsible Regulation, the Whitman case some years ago, where what seemed like a clear issue of statutory interpretation below became an entirely different judgment above. It's difficult, even when you have the full context, to say that one issue is so simple that it can be decided readily. It's that much more difficult when you're making a decision based on a tentative legal analysis.
Is that the nature of the comments she's made to the public? That is that tentative?
I don't think any of her comments have talked about specifically, have sort of said, well, this is exactly what the final rule is going to be that I would sign. All she has said is that I'm confident we will move forward. But she still has to prepare her final legal rationale.
How about her answer to Senator Wicker, who asked her, Section 11D says if it's regulated under 112, you can't regulate it. And her answer was, I think that the framing of the legal argument is incorrect, Senator. I know she's not a lawyer. I guess she's not a lawyer. I don't know. But
I think, again, that is still not the articulation of her final legal rationale. And I guess I would also point out this is not a case – this is a case dealing with a charge that the Supreme Court has recognized Congress clearly has to decide whether and how to regulate greenhouse gases. So the question of whether it may do so under this particular section of the statute in the end is still a question that should be left to the administrator to resolve in the first instance in the course of the rulemaking. There's nothing about that question that makes it different from all others and requires that it be reviewed differently than how Congress designed the statute to work. And in fact, City of Arlington is an important case on that point because the court there specifically held that there is no difference, no meaningful difference for purposes of the validity of agency action between a claim that an agency is exceeding its authority and a claim that it's improperly applying its authority. They're all one and the same. In the end, it's always a question of whether the agency has gone beyond what Congress permitted it to do. But under 7607, those claims are always heard after the agency takes a final rulemaking action.
Let me ask you about 7607. Do you have it in front of you?
I do.
Okay. That first sentence, which is the one we're under, does not say other final action. It talks about promulgating the standards under 711D, which is where we are, and then a bunch of other standards and controls and prohibitions and determinations. And then it says, are any other nationally applicable regulations promulgated or final action taken by the administrator? And then you look down at the second sentence, which is the one controlling the state implementation plans, and that does say, or any other final action. It seems, unless that's a Scrivener's error, it seems as if the first sentence in beginning by saying a petition for review of action in promulgating, no final there, and in promulgating, at least to me, indicates in the process of promulgating it. And the definition of promulgate actually has two, one that would support the petitioners to make known or public the terms of a proposed law. There's also another definition that helps the EPA.
Your Honor, I would say that sentence does not govern here.
Which one does, then?
If you're referring to the sentence, a petition for review of the administrator's action in approving or promulgating any implementation plan
that doesn't
under
apply
7411, I believe the sentence that is controlling here is earlier.
That's right.
Any standard
of
performance or requirement.
What I'm asking you is this. The first sentence, which is the one we're under, does not say other final action the way the second sentence does, which to me indicates that unless it's a Scrivener's error, they left out other for some reason in the first one.
I'm reading it. Petition for review of action of the administrator in promulgating, and then skipping
skip
text,
down
that's clearly
lines.
Not applicable that relates to 7412. Any standard of performance or requirement under 7411 of this title. I believe this proposal is a standard of performance or requirement under 7411, comma, or any other nationally applicable regulations promulgated or other final action taken. Those ors are not
other.
Referring to
it
something
say
already
other.
Listed. They're
Look
referring
at,
to something else.
It, you just said other final action. It doesn't
well,
say
Well, no, I
other.
Didn't. I said or any other nationally applicable regulations promulgated or final action
All right.
taken.
I heard you say or.
But,
other
but my point would be that there would no be, if you have already listed a specific type of national promulgated rule that can be reviewed upon promulgation, why would you then have meant to refer to it again in the phrase that says, or any other? Other must mean something
All right,
else.
Why do you do it in the second sentence then?
Well, we have listed in our brief examples of actions that the administrator may take that are final but that don't go through notice and comment. I can look at my brief and give you the example.
All right, well, let me turn to this 60-day requirement that you say keeps the interveners out because they filed their petition for review after 60 days of the notice in the Federal Register. Now, you first say in your brief on page 16 that none of the interveners can stand in Murray's shoes because they did not file within 60 days after the publication on June 18th of last year. Then, on page 22, you say, this is the argument Murray makes about the presumption of finality. Were such a precedent established, claimants that disagree with EPA's legal interpretations in any future proposed rule likely would be forced to sue within 60 days of publication of the proposal. Otherwise, it'd be deemed untimely. Now, on the one hand, you seem to be saying the intervener's out of time because they filed after 60 days. On the one hand. On the other hand, you say they can't be forced to file within the 60 days.
I think there's a couple of different issues here, and let me try to address all of them. If we're talking about Article III ripeness, this Court has already held in the Coalition for Responsible Regulation case that it was the promulgation of a final rule, not merely its proposal, that made issues ripe. But there, specifically, the question was, the Court held that disputes with EPA's interpretation of the Act's permitting triggers for the PSD program did not constitutionally ripen until EPA promulgated the tailpipe rule as a final regulation. That's 684 F3rd at 131. And the consequence of that was that the 60-day limitations period did not begin to run until final rule promulgation. And as the courts observed, we don't have, on the other hand, any case in which the court has held that a proposed rule created an Article III case or controversy. So that's one issue, and that deals with the proposed rule. In terms of the settlement agreement, though, the states have argued that this agreement itself, as soon as EPA entered it, was a reviewable final action because EPA had completed the 113G process. And what we said about that is, well, EPA announced the finalization of that agreement after the MATS rule had already been promulgated and was on the books. Therefore, if the states had the objection that this agreement required EPA to do something unlawful, and they say that EPA was contractually obligated to do so, then it seems that their claim had ripened once EPA announced the finalization of the agreement, and yet they did not sue within 60 days. Reality is, we think that's because they don't really have an objection to the settlement agreement. What they're really concerned about is the proposed rule. And they didn't invoke the All Writs Act to seek extraordinary relief. But if they had, we think that that claim would be subject to the same problems we observed about Murray's.
I'm talking about your red brief in Murray, which has nothing to do with the settlement agreement. But that's okay. Go on.
Well, in terms of Murray's challenge, again, we would say that they've not shown that, first of all, their writ would clearly enlarge the court's jurisdiction. Second, they have not shown that the remedy afforded to them and exclusively afforded to them by Congress in 7607 is inadequate. It has proven adequate for all sorts of rules that were also of great economic and environmental significance and that also involved claims that the agency was acting unlawfully. They've not shown why it is somehow uniquely inadequate here. Cases they cited like McCulloch and Leadham v. Kine are cases in which there was no remedy available to deal with the statutory right or protect the statutory right at issue. And in those cases did not even involve the All Writs Act. Cases such as Colonial Times, that was mentioned earlier, are cases in which there was an issue below that would have evaded review. These issues, statutory authority questions, can never evade review. It is fair game once the agency takes a final rulemaking action and they can seek to stay that rule. They can seek expedited relief of that rule if the circumstances warrant. But the issue would be available for consideration by the court at that time in the manner Congress intended. And I would also point the court to the case Aluminum Company of America, which again, this court in that case held that there was no exception to the finality doctrine merely because the claim was that the agency exceeded its statutory authority. In that case, it assumed authority over pending proceedings in state agency in Texas, and the court said that that was not final yet, and it would be after the conclusion of those proceedings that the case could then be reviewed in federal court. I would refer the court as well to the Ayuda case cited in our brief, in which this court, although vacated on other grounds, held that the writ cannot be used before a case becomes ripe or before an agency action is final. Otherwise, it would be easy to bypass those jurisdictional limitations in every case. I see my time is running out. If I may briefly conclude, the court should dismiss these petitions and allow both the agency's decision-making process and the normal judicial review process to move forward at the time and in the manner that Congress intended.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Berman?
Good morning. Your Honors, I'd like to make just a couple of points in response to what petitioners have said. But before I turn to those, I think there's one threshold issue that merits some discussion, and that is the limited nature of the question that's before the Court today. The question the Court has to answer, if it reaches the merits, if it gets past all the jurisdictional hurdles that my colleague has addressed, is not, unlike in most cases addressing EPA action, it's not whether what the agency has done or said is reasonable, and it's certainly not whether what petitioners, how they read the statute is reasonable. The question is limited to whether EPA gets its ordinary opportunity to interpret the statute and to tell this Court not only whether it thinks it has authority to regulate power plant carbon dioxide emissions, but why it has that authority. And, Your Honors, I think that if there's even a scintilla of a shred of potential ambiguity in Section 7411D, EPA has to be given that chance. I think we're well beyond a shred here for all the reasons we've explained in our brief. We have two different amendments.
Scintilla of a shred of ambiguity?
Sorry,
that's a new standard for me. Scintilla of a shred of ambiguity? Well, everything in the English language is ambiguous under that.
Well, Your Honor, what I'm saying is reflecting the weird posture we're in here. We're
okay.
Asking about, do we get to do our normal job of interpreting the statute? And I think that if there's a potential for ambiguity, then you have to let EPA explain whether it thinks there is ambiguity and why. And that's what we're asking the Court to let EPA do here. As we've said, the sources for that ambiguity, we have two differing amendments. We've got many ambiguities even in the House amended text. But even if we set
all
those...
According to Professor Tribe, we don't have that ambiguity because we shouldn't be looking at the Senate version as a source of law at all. So that's not a matter of ambiguity. That's a matter of understanding how a bill becomes a law, right? So what's your response to...
Well, my response is that, with due respect, I think he's flat out wrong there. The Supreme Court has said in the Stefan v. United States in 1943, the very meaning of prima facie is that the code cannot prevail over the statutes at large where there's an inconsistency. There's an inconsistency here. We have to look at both. EPA is not choosing.
There's a conflict or an inconsistency?
Well, that's one of the things EPA has to decide, Your Honor. You know, in the past, and petitioners have pointed to a lot of past statements from EPA, in the past, everybody has always agreed that the statute was ambiguous because of the Senate amendment. That was petitioners agreed with that in 2005, 10 years ago, and I have a hard time seeing how there's no potential for ambiguity now when 10 years ago everybody thought this was ambiguous. But now, you know, people have pointed out to EPA in comments, in light of that argument, that the House amendment actually has a lot more ambiguity than EPA has maybe ever recognized, and EPA has to have the chance to address those arguments as well. So, you know, although petitioners surely wish it had been, Title 42 of the code hasn't been enacted into positive law. And unless or until that happens, it's the statutes that say what the law is. It's not EPA, it's not petitioners, and it's certainly not the Office of Law Revision Council, which is a mere functionary of the Speaker of the House. So we can't just ignore the Senate amendment. It's not an illusion. It is there. And a reasonable interpretation of the statute has to deal with that fact. And EPA should be given the chance to reconcile those two amendments, as this court has said is the preferred course in the Spencer County case, and most recently in Shialaba. You know, even setting aside the Chevron application issue, I think almost every opinion contained the idea that, well, before we decide there's a conflict, we should try to reconcile the statutory language if possible. EPA should be given that chance here. Now, second, Your Honors, even if we're talking about the text of 7411D, as amended by the House only, I think there's a lot of reasons why a reading that would bar EPA from regulating non-hazardous pollutants under 7411D, simply because hazardous pollutants have, from that source category are regulated under 7412, there's a lot of reasons why that might not be a reasonable reading, let alone the only possible reading. It's inconsistent with the overall scheme set forth in the Act, where Congress created three programs to address these three different categories of pollutants. That
so argument, if we just had the Supreme Court statement in footnote 7, that would be a problem for you.
I don't think that statement really is a problem, Your Honor. Let me tell you why. There's a couple of reasons. First, nobody briefed this issue in AEP. There's no indication that the court was aware that we had two different amendments to the code language. Now, beyond that, though, the main thrust of the AEP decision was that 7411D, not state law, is the appropriate mechanism for regulating carbon dioxide emissions from existing power plants. And the court said that that decision was issued after the mercury and air toxics rule was proposed, so after EPA had proposed to regulate power plants under 112. Now, if we look at the
right,
text...
Right, and those are good arguments about not reading an isolated footnote too broadly, I suppose, but that footnote on its own would be something if we were to reach the merits.
Let me try to explain to you why I really still don't think it would be something
even
there.
Even on its face.
And okay. I'm looking at the language of it right now. So the footnote seems to mostly paraphrase the U.S. Code on a first glance. But in fact, it uses pollutant-specific language. In the middle, it has a phrase of if existing stationary sources of the pollutant in question are regulated. But moreover, it then, in the next breath, refers to both the National Ambient Air Quality Standard Program, the Criteria Pollutant Program, and the Hazardous Air Pollutants Program. And it refers to them like those two exclusions work the same way. Well, if petitioners are right about what the Supreme Court was saying in that footnote, then the Supreme Court got it wrong, at least in regard to criteria pollutants, because nobody disagrees that the criteria pollutant exclusion is a pollutant-specific exclusion. So either the Supreme Court got it wrong or we're way over reading that footnote, and that's what I think we're doing here. Your Honor, I'd also like to point out that their reading is in tension with Section 7412D7, which was also enacted by Congress in 1990.
I'm probably moving away from where you are right now, but on the Senate amendment, what about the statement of the Senate managers?
I think we are turning a true molehill into a mountain there. So,
well, that's I'm not certain what to do with that, frankly. You have potentially conflicting amendments that it seems, if you look at anything beyond the actual text, and I realize there's one view, just look at the actual text and stick with that, but if you look at anything beyond the actual text, it does seem that the process was intended for the Senate to recede on that amendment.
Well, okay, so a couple of things about that. First off, this court addressed the same statement in the EDF v. EPA case and said that it can't undermine the statute's language. And the reason the court gave was that this is not, unlike I think somebody on the other side incorrectly said, something that was signed onto by the conferees. This is not a conference statement. It's a statement of the Senate managers only because they weren't happy with what was in the conference statement. But more importantly, that statement, it's this broad and bland statement that the Senate recedes to the House in regards to the content of Section 108, which contained a lot of stuff, a lot of it about transportation provisions. So even if we assume that, you know, the face value of that just means that the Senate doesn't disagree with this stuff being in the bill. But that statement says nothing about the separate Section 302. And in fact, that section isn't covered at all in the Senate manager's statement. So we can't assume that in saying this about 108, they're saying, oh, and what we did in 302 is wrong also. And if somebody thought what was in 302 was wrong, then it wouldn't be in the bill. We have to assume that just as the Senate receded to the House in regards to 108, the House receded to the Senate in regards to 302, or it wouldn't be in the bill, because recedes just means we withdraw our disagreements with this section. So I think we're way over reading that as well. And I did want to point the court to 7412D7, where Congress in 1990 said that the Section 112 program isn't supposed to diminish or replace Section 7411 standards or requirements. And that shows that Congress was explicitly contemplating that the standards promulgated under both sections would continue to apply to the same sources. And finally, I think their reading is also in tension with the legislative history that contains absolutely no evidence that Congress intended to restrict the scope of Section 7411D in the dramatic way that they are saying it did. In fact, the Congressional Research Service itself, in 1993, just 3 years after the amendments, characterized the two differing amendments as duplicative language that was trying to do the same thing. Now, petitioners have a theory about why Congress would want to do what they think it was doing, even though it never said anything about it, and this is their double regulation theory. But first, this is revisionist history. Sorry. There's nothing on which it's based in the legislative history.
Well, the absence of legislative history, though, could cut both ways here in the bigger picture of the absence of any indication of this huge grant of authority, the kind of elephant in mouse holes origination by the Supreme Court, right?
Well, I think the elephant in the mouse hole really does apply because you know, cutting back to almost nothing the scope of 7411D would be quite an elephant. And what we do have consistent throughout the legislative history. But what we do have consistent throughout the legislative history is this idea that Congress was unhappy with what EPA had done so far in 1990 and wanted to cover more pollutants under more programs. There's nothing in there that, despite having that consistent intent in regard to HAFs and acid rain, oh, and by the way, we're trying to eviscerate the 7411D program at the same time, even though we're not saying that. So, I just think the legislative history leans heavily towards a reading of 7411D that doesn't completely undo it.
If we would agree with you that this is Chevron, if we got to the merits and agreed with you that this is Chevron case, what's the intelligible principle that that reconciles these two?
Well, it's not so much, I don't think it's really a question of intelligible principle there. I think, you know, if we're talking about non-delegation, we have a clear intent on the part of Congress to delegate the Clean Air Act and its administration and its interpretation to the EPA, and this Court has recognized that in a number of its cases. I think, though, under the Supreme Court's recent decision in Shialaba, that's my pronunciation, I'm going to stick with it.
Yeah, that's probably right.
I think the Court has spoken clearly, and five justices think that Chevron still applies, even if we're talking about a potential internal conflict between two phrases in the same provision, because that's what was at issue in Shialaba. It was actually pretty analogous, I think. Not quite on point, but they were talking about the language within the same provision that seemed to point Janus faced in opposite directions. And we have five justices who think Chevron still applies there. So I think that is clearly still the law of the land in regard to that issue. But even if one disagrees with that, as, for example, the Chief Justice did, what a number of the justices also articulated is this idea that we should try to reconcile apparently conflicting language before we decide that there's a real conflict. And I think, you know, that's what EPA should be allowed to do here, to see if it can reconcile that language and use it, use its authority that Congress has given it to do that.
And that is a splintered opinion, obviously, to take up statements out of a splintered opinion and transform them to this different context is also something we'd have to be careful about doing, I would think, too.
Yes, but, you know, pointing to another aspect of the Chevron question here, what petitioners are really asking you to do, Judge Kavanaugh, is to bifurcate the Chevron analysis. They're saying, do Chevron 1 now, agree with us, and you won't have to do Chevron 2. I really don't think there's any case law out there that suggests that's appropriate. And, in fact, we've got case law like the Entergy case where the courts basically said, you know, we don't necessarily have to do both steps fully. You know, if the agency interpretation is reasonable, we're not going to go through step one. And if Congress has spoken directly and it's as clear as they think it is, then any agency contradicting it, interpretation that contradicts what Congress has said would be unreasonable. So I don't think it's appropriate to bifurcate the Chevron analysis in the way that they're asking you to here. Now, finally, I'd briefly just like to address the comments on the constitutional issues raised by Counsel for Peabody. Counsel for Peabody suggests that the proposed rule raises some constitutional issues, and this court should forbid EPA from moving forward to avoid those issues. I think this turns the doctrine of constitutional avoidance on its head. That canon of construction cautions courts to avoid reading statutes to unnecessarily create constitutional issues. It does not support the proposition that courts should prohibit agencies from completing an administrative rulemaking process because the product, the thing they do at the end, might, depending on what's in it, raise a constitutional
issue. In fact, isn't the notion behind it that you wait as long as possible to let the dust settle so that you know what you're deciding, right?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. Okay. And if the final rule,
I think
in fact,
what they're saying is that the interpretation that has so far been articulated would create serious federalism concerns, and therefore, to the extent there's a choice, in your view, between how you interpret the statute, well, don't interpret it to cause these serious federalism concerns. I'm oversimplifying, but I think that's their argument, and that's an argument the Supreme Court has accepted in cases like Bond and others. Again, wildly different contexts, but the principle's out there.
Well, but, Your Honor, so the federalism concerns that they've articulated here, and I do feel like I have to point out these are arguments raised by an intervener They're not arguments raised by the petitioners. I don't really think...
If they're good, they're good. If they're not good, they're not good.
Well, let me tell you why I think they're not good, okay? So, counsel for Peabody spoke about vertical and horizontal, and I'm not even sure which was which. But talking about the one federalism issue he seemed to be articulating was this idea that EPA shouldn't be able to choose, that it's taking Congress's role if it's choosing between the Senate and the House amendments. And as I just said, I think we've got this Supreme Court sort of rejecting that idea recently in the Shialaba case. You know, EPA isn't choosing here. It's just recognizing what is there in the statutes at large.
Well, I think the federalism issue, I'm not sure if Shialaba is really going to get to that, right? Because it's an overarching principle of, okay, maybe in the ordinary course you'd have two interpretations that would be plausible. But when you load one of them with the federalism concerns, that now becomes an unreasonable choice, taking it out of the Shialaba kind of box.
But the federalism concerns that are being loaded here, those all deal with the content of the rule. Mm-hmm. And we can't analyze what those are or whether they exist until we know what's in the final rule.
Yeah, well, that's a separate,
and I think it's very unfair to suggest that what might be in the final rule, whether that might raise constitutional issues,
and
should be avoided here.
I totally understand you on the finality point. Yeah. I completely get that. And I'm just talking about what, if we were on the merits.
Well, I'm just saying, he seems to be raising a 10th Amendment issue. We can't have a meaningful conversation about that right now. We don't know what's in the proposed.
Right. So that's just doubling down on the finality. I understand.
Okay.
Yeah.
But
I raise that point as an invitation to Professor Tribe to deal with it. The constitutional avoidance doctrine seems to cut against the jurisdictional argument here, but it hasn't been decided yet, right?
Yeah. And I think we can't have a meaningful discussion about these issues until we have a final rule here. Yeah. So, you know. And I would again reiterate that these weren't raised by petitioners in their briefs. And as a result, they haven't been briefed, Your Honor. I mean, if this court is really going to decide this case based on these constitutional issues, then I would suggest that supplemental briefing would be needed on those issues. But I see I'm over time, so I'll just conclude briefly. Your Honors, if this statutory provision, with its convoluted structure, with its vague terms, and with its two amendments to the relevant text, if this is an ambiguity, I really think it begs the question, what is? But the court doesn't have to decide how ambiguous Section 7411D is or whether any of the readings that have been suggested by EPA, by petitioners, or otherwise are reasonable. The only question for the court right now is whether EPA should get its ordinary opportunity to interpret the statute, to tell you not only whether it thinks it has authority here, but why it thinks it has authority here. Thank you.
Are you still on track for June of this year?
Your Honor, actually, I'm glad you asked that. The administrator had put out a statement saying it would be this summer, so it might not be June. We might be looking at 3 months instead of two or something like that, but it will be this summer is the thinking.
Okay.
And that also brings up an interesting issue of the interplay with the MATS rule decision, which will be in June. So by the time we have a final rule and petition challenging it, we'll know what's happening under Section 112, and I think that's worth noting as well. Thank you.
Okay. Costello.
May it please the Court. Morgan Costello for Respondent Intervenor States. I'd like to summarize two key procedural points related to finality and ripeness and to address the legal relevance of the settlement agreement challenged by the West Virginia petitioners. The fundamental flaw here is that petitioners' claims are premature, and there's nothing truly exceptional about their claims that warrants the unprecedented relief that they seek. On finality, petitioners' statutory authority claims are not unique. Petitioners' challenges are not different from many cases before this court in which parties challenged a final rulemaking or other final action as an excess of an agency's statutory authority. Some recent examples involving claims just with EPA, that EPA exceeded its statutory authority, include the EME Homer City case, National Association of Clean Water Agencies, and the Mingo Logan Coal case. All of these cases, even those that involve large, complicated rulemakings, were heard and decided by this court only after EPA had promulgated a final rule. This court has never before allowed a party to stop a rulemaking midstream. And they have not identified any standards to separate this case from those or that would prevent others from seeking to file similar premature claims to non-final, non-binding proposed regulations. That The legal authority here has been stated in definitive terms. It does not make their claims unique either because, like most agencies, EPA is required to set forth in its proposed regulations the legal interpretations underlying its proposed rule. And under petitioner's theory, anybody who disagreed with those legal interpretations could file a premature challenge. The petitioners are challenging an agency's legal interpretation of its authority to act at all also does not distinguish their claims. As Justice Scalia explained in the City of Arlington case, that distinction is merely one of semantics. The statutory authority issue raised by petitioners should be reviewed under the Chevron framework, with the benefit of the agency's definitive statutory construction and their final reasoning after considering all comments and promulgating a final rule. As to ripeness, the petitioner's allegations of hardship also are not a basis to distinguish this case. Petitioner's allegations stem from voluntary, not mandated actions. When a rule is proposed, it cannot, as a matter of law, legally obligate anyone to do anything. States cannot make their claims ripe through their own voluntary actions. And it is common for states to spend resources analyzing a proposed rule, preparing comments on that rule, and to begin to prepare to comply with any requirements they may have to meet once the rule is finalized. If participation in the administrative rulemaking process and advanced planning were basis for being able to bring a challenge to a proposed rule, those challenges would be brought all the time. As a practical matter, states are not forced to act now. The claims of hardship are primarily related to concerns about the timeline for preparing state plans and meeting compliance deadlines, and those concerns are overblown. EPA has specifically sought comments from states on the plan submittal and compliance deadlines, so those deadlines are all subject to change in the final rule. The rule, as proposed, includes provisions that would allow states to seek extensions of time up to 2 years if they need more time to prepare a complete plan. The rule also provides for long implementation periods and specifically builds on energy and environmental planning efforts that states and utilities are already undertaking. The Clean Air Act is replete with examples of EPA setting ambitious goals for states and for states working with EPA and meeting them. And the state respondent interviewers support this rule and think it is a workable rule. Once it is finalized, petitioners, like everyone else, can obtain review of the rule in the normal course. And like every other challengers who believe that they may be irreparably harmed by a final rule, they can file a motion for a stay, in which they must demonstrate all the required elements. This court should not depart from that standard practice here. Finally, with regard to the West Virginia petitioners, they cannot avoid these finality and ripeness problems by challenging the settlement agreement for two reasons. First, they're not harmed by the agreement. The states or interveners are not here because they think that the agreement imposes binding obligations on EPA to promulgate final standards under Section 111B. The settlement agreement merely agreed to a rulemaking schedule. It did not commit EPA to promulgating any final standards. It didn't commit to anything substantive, and it did not take away any procedural rights. It merely agreed to take some final action, and the EPA still has discretion as to what that final action is and whether it's going to include 111D standards. The parties could not use the settlement agreement to compel EPA to take any action because the remedy was limited to filing a new petition or motion seeking to compel EPA to respond to a remand in a prior case, New York versus EPA, before this court. As in the Defenders of Wildlife versus Perciasepe case, EPA's statements about its intent to finalize a rule are not sufficient to establish causation for purposes of Article III standing. And as this court noted, the petitioners' states were not parties to that agreement, and so they lack standing. Second, even if they had any injury.
You need to wind it up because you're over your time.
If they had any injury related to the settlement agreement, their claims are barred by the 60-day statute of limitations. When the finalization of the settlement agreement was announced in April 2012, EPA had already promulgated the mercury and air toxics rule, and all the elements of their claimed illegality existed at that time. Under Eagle Pitcher, it was petitioner's burden to file a protective petition for review within the 60-day statutory period, and courts don't hypothesize whether, in retrospect, a claim would have been ripe had it been brought within the statutory period. just 20 seconds to conclude. In conclusion, this is not an extraordinary case warranting this court's jurisdictionally premature review. Petitioner's statutory authority arguments can and should be addressed in the normal course once the rule is finalized. And there is no substantial hardship in the interim because petitioners are not legally or practically obligated to do anything. We therefore ask that the court dismiss all of the petitions.
All right, thank you. Mr. Donahue.
Good morning. May it please the court. Sean Donahue for the environmental interveners. We agree with the government that these petitions are premature and they're in flagrant violation of the review scheme that Congress enacted in 1977, the Clean Air Act. As Mr. Link pointed out, Section 7607D9 expressly makes clear that claims that an agency has violated the Constitution or is acting in excess of its statutory jurisdiction or authority are among those claims that a court can consider on proper review of a final rule. There's nothing that would allow, there's no exception. As the court knows, claims that an agency has exceeded its authority or even violated the Constitution are routine, and the idea that there can be this two-step review process would completely flout Congress's intent and would bring this court into contact with an entirely new procedure. At a minimum, the court would get myriad protective petitions for review, because if part of the agency's decision on authority or anything else is deemed to be final at the proposed rule stage, then people have to challenge it, and they no doubt would. Notably here, many, many parties that really don't like this rule. The state of Texas, a notably aggressive litigant against the government's proposals to regulate carbon, haven't participated, didn't file these premature petitions.
But I bet you they're ready.
Yeah, and they will have a full opportunity. And that brings me to the point, when they challenge, the agency's rationale matters. It's not just the ultimate conclusion whether the agency has authority or not. For example, it's been assumed, the petitioner's arguments assumed, that the whole question is the Senate amendment and how do you treat it. And as Ms. Berman demonstrated, that alone is certainly reason to let the agency at least have its say and explain its views, because the court will need that to address that difficult statutory question. Whether or not you ultimately conclude that it's something that should be treated under Chevron or something else, it's totally extraordinary to not let the agency decide first. They admitted they have no case, and there is none. But we think the premise that everything depends on the Senate amendment is wrong. We think the House amendment clearly, with respect to the pollutants at issue here, which are those that are not and cannot be regulated under Section 112, we think that it's best read not to preclude the agency from regulating those under either program. That would be very aberrant under the Clean Air Act, that because a pollutant is a source is regulated for one pollutant, it can't be regulated for different pollutants with different health and environmental effects. There's nothing like that in the Act.
Well, but the language of the House amendment, and it may have been itself sloppily drafted and put aside the whole Senate amendment, does, on its face, at least create a problem for what you just said.
We don't think so. We think that the reference to Section 112 and to the notion of pollutants regulated under 112 and sources regulated under 112, it can readily be limited to pollutants, to those pollutants, to the exclusion being limited to the pollutants that are actually regulated under 112. And in fact, as the Institute for Policy Integrity amicus brief shows, EPA has read Section 111D since 1990. Every administration has read it to allow, in a way that would allow, regulation of non-hazardous air pollutants. The rationales have been different. Maybe the issues haven't been squarely presented, but now they are. But the idea that this is some kind of bizarre departure is completely wrong. So we think if ever there were a case to abandon this very clear statutory structure, this is not it. There's clearly a very strong basis. The Supreme Court mentioned 111D seven times in the AEP opinion, and industry there was saying, this is the provision, this is the way you deal with carbon under the Clean Air Act. It's a flexible provision. It allows for the kinds of regulatory tools that make sense with respect to carbon. And so the idea that all of a sudden EPA is prohibited from doing so is remarkable, and the agencies should be allowed to conduct a rulemaking and explore it and reach a final decision. Many of the petitioners here supported as reasonable EPA's construction in the Clean Air Mercury Rule proceeding that, again, would allow regulation of non-hazardous air pollutants under 111D. Ms. Berman mentioned Section 7412D7. That provision is completely inconsistent with the petitioner's theory that Congress had this anti-double regulation purpose in enacting the amendments in 1990, because it says that 112 standards shall not be construed to diminish 111. So EPA at least, and some of the hundreds of comments, remember there are millions of comments that the agency is considering now, which goes to the when they're going to be able to finish it this summer, millions of comments, and many of those comments, including by all the parties, all the interveners and petitioners here, address this very question. And the agency will be conducting a much more careful and focused analysis of this statutory question. So consider how bizarre this proceeding is now. Petitioners file a premature lawsuit. The agency responds. The petitioners challenge the agency's discussion of the statute as litigating positions of counsel. Well, that's because the agency hasn't finished its work yet. And that's just one, that and the petition for review problem are just two of the myriad ways that this brand new procedure they're trying to bring up here would really scramble the process that Congress established. Finally, I would submit that this case is just like the Las Brisas case, which involved a challenge to the proposed standards under 111B for new sources. With many of the same claims of immediate hardship, the agency has completely gone beyond its authority, and the court should step in. The court handled that exactly the way it should have. There's no final rule dismissed, and that's exactly, we submit, what the agency should do here. With the court's indulgence, I would just suggest one other thing on Judge Henderson's question about construing the judicial review provision in Section 7607B. I think that it becomes very clear that promulgated rules are final rules when you read it together with 7607D6, which compares the promulgated rule with the proposed rule. They're different things. There's this very carefully constructed process here. Almost all of the parties interested in this important rulemaking are playing by the rules and participating in that rulemaking, whether they strongly oppose it or they strongly support it, like the state of New York and others. They will all have their opportunity to review EPA's final decision, including on these statutory questions, and bring any claims of illegality to this court. Thank you very much.
Madam Clerk, is there any time left for any? All right, would you give each one 5 minutes? All right, Mr. Lynn.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have a few points on the threshold issues, but if I could first, three very, very brief points on the merits. There was a lot of talk about the House amendment, the U.S. Code version being ambiguous. There are all these readings that have been suggested now. But just to get to the question that Judge Kavanaugh asked about, you know, are these on-ramps or are these off-ramps? I mean, that's emblematic of these ambiguities that are newly discovered. There has been no question since 1970 that these are all prohibitions. I mean, and that is before even the 1990 amendments, when this was phrased as three ors, you know, an or and then another or. Even EPA has said from the beginning in promulgated regulations has said these are prohibitions. On the dueling amendments issue, I think one of the important things to remember is, you know, this has happened a lot. And we have a footnote that talks about all the different revisers' notes. And, you know, this court and the Supreme Court have always assumed that Congress legislates against the backdrop of these kinds of procedures that they know. And they know this is how Law Revision Council deals with conflicting, conforming amendments, which is what the Senate amendment is, and a substantive amendment. But even as Judge Griffith has said, if there is truly a conflict here, I don't think the Cielo case resolves this. I mean, there are five justices there who said that it could be a Chevron issue, but remember that Chevron Step 1 requires the application of ordinary principles of statutory interpretation. And this court in Liberty Maritime and the Supreme Court in Borden have said that you need to give conflicting provisions their maximum effect, and there is only one way to do that here, which Judge Kavanaugh had suggested. And then finally, there have been a lot of references to the elephants and mouse holes analogy, but let me give you another colorful analogy. The EPA said, you know, there's no legislative history here, but as the Supreme Court said in Harrison, there is no dog that does not bark theory of legislative history. The fact that Congress did not specifically say anything doesn't mean that that's not what the statute, that the text doesn't mean what it says. On the threshold issues, let me turn first to Judge Henderson's question about the White Stallion case in the Supreme Court. And I think, as Mr. Barnes said, that's really a question of prudential ripeness. And the first and most important thing is that it's a waivable issue, as the Supreme Court has said. We raised that very issue in a footnote in our opening brief where we said, here is a way, there are two ways that the EPA can deal with the 112 exclusion, either delist power plants, wait and see what happens after the Supreme Court rules. If they lose, promise not to relist them. They did not address that. They have not. They have thrown every threshold argument they can think of against the wall, and the one that's missing is that the White Stallion case will have any effect at all on the ripeness of this issue. And then as far as the timing and, you know, whether this rule is going to be final in 2 months, you know, that just gets to, and this gets to the sort of fundamental disconnect here about what the issue here is. I mean, what's happening here is states and petitioners and the industry petitioners are being forced to do things. This is not simply participation in the administrative process, and the declarations make that very clear. This is not stuff that at least our states have been doing or would be doing anyway. For the petitioning states and the intervener states, what we're doing, because we have to do it given the 13-month time frame that we have after the finalization of the rule, these are not things we will be spending taxpayer dollars on. You know, these are not the contemplated legislation, the contemplated rules, all things that draft legislation that we have to submit with our initial plan 13 months after the finalization of the rule. These are not things that at least our states would be doing. And that's important, I think, to remember that with every passing day, every passing week, and every passing month, no matter how soon this final rule may come out, these are taxpayer dollars and resources.
There's practical preparation, no doubt, and I acknowledge that, and I think it's a mistake to diminish that. But on the other hand, there's the formality that we rely on principles for reviewability, and I think your response to that is this is a really big, extraordinary case. But how do you respond to the idea that in really big, extraordinary cases, we should be all the more following the ordinary principles of reviewability and making certain that we abide by those just because, even though it's a big, extraordinary case?
Right, and I think the answer to that is, I think it would be remarkable to suggest that an extraordinary writ could never issue in a case where there is a proposed rulemaking. I think the phrase necessary and appropriate in the All Writs Act contemplates that there are times where the ordinary appeal process is inadequate.
But we've never found one. This would be the first one. So this would be the first one.
But there's always a first.
Yeah.
And we think
we like to make history.
And we think this would be the last. And I think that's. we think, you know, there's always a first, and we think this would be the last for the three reasons I articulated. And I think just to conclude,
In terms of timing, they've told you you can move for a stay as soon as the final rule is out there. Could be 8 weeks. Take us time to write an opinion.
Could be 8 weeks. Could be 12 weeks. For the 111B rule, what was January has now become June. But that, again, gets back to the practical harms that we're talking about and the fact that this is essentially regulation by inertia. I mean, they have gone ahead and as Judge Henderson said that they're going to do this rule, and you heard it today from EPA counsel. You know, when is this rule going to be final? It will be final this summer, which is what she said. And
she didn't say what it would say.
No, but I mean, ultimately, and I think that's the important issue here. This is not about all the various possibilities, right? This is an absolute prohibition that if we are right about this, there is nothing more that they can do. There is no possible explanation they can give, no tweaking of the rule, no paring back of the building blocks that can make this rule lawful under 111D. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Barnes.
Your Honor, just a very brief point. EPA has raised a series of arguments as to why they need additional time in the full process of the comment period. But nowhere, anywhere, as the agency suggested, there is any basis whatsoever in Section 111D on which the rest of this is based. And essentially what the agency, in the meantime, as has been described, there is significant, immediate, ongoing harm. And so that where you have a single legal issue that is fundamental to the rule can be and is a an initial preliminary decision where the agency has not suggested anywhere that there's any basis under Section 111D, and where there is a clear legal issue, it's teed up. I certainly doubt the court would want more briefing on this topic. Under these circumstances, we believe that the extraordinary writ is appropriate. And what I'd like to do here is cede the rest of my time to Professor Trott.
All right.
Thank you. I might begin by the suggestion by Judge Griffith that constitutional avoidance sort of cuts against us on jurisdiction. Constitutional avoidance, as I understand it, is not a principle of cowardice. It's a principle of not attributing to Congress unnecessarily the intention to create a serious constitutional problem. So if there were ambiguity here, that avoidance principle of respecting Congress trumps Chevron deference, and that's really well established. So that if there were warring versions, and I think there aren't, and if one couldn't just obviously reconcile them by following them both, because as I suggested earlier, they're not inconsistent, if there were residual ambiguity, it still would not do them any good. Because as General Lynn pointed out, no matter what happens with the rule, there is something very fundamental that they're not even remotely suggesting they're going to cure. They're not suggesting that they won't use 111D mm-hmm. in circumstances where the plain language of the statute says you can't use it for source categories that you're regulating under 112. That issue is fully teed up for review, and it really would be a terrible waste for everybody for them to go on under the illusion that they have a statutory authority that they don't have. And the issues of state sovereignty are also fully teed up. Now, I want to stress that I'm here representing all 14 intervener states, as well as Peabody and NFIG and UARG, NFIB and UARG. And from the perspective of those states, not only is the EPA sort of coloring outside the lines, attempting to do something the statute clearly forbids, and coming up with every imaginable rationale to defend it. They've come up with so many in the course of just this proceeding that I can't imagine that the ones they might still invent after the notice and comment period is over will be any better, frankly, than these are. The statute speaks for itself. It's clear that they're trying to make law, not execute law. And it's clear to me, anyway, that under the principles of the Prince case, the gun background check case, they are commandeering the states. They're commanding them to get ready, and not only to get ready, but to expend resources to plan for statutes and regulations that will meet their demands. Now, their suggestion is, unless you know what's going to be in our secret backup plan that we're going to announce sometime this summer, you can't tell whether there's a violation of Prince. Well, that just is not right. The Supreme Court made very clear in Prince, in the opinion by Justice Scalia, that it is a categorical structural imperative, one that cannot be balanced away by countervailing considerations. It didn't matter how much effort the chief local law enforcement officers had to engage in as at the sort of the end of the line of command set up by the federal government, that violated the basic structure of our government. And a principle that they've never really tried to answer is that the fallback regulation itself is one that you don't need to see in order to assess from this perspective. There is a principle as old as the 1950s that offers to withhold direct federal regulation or direct state regulation, but here in the federalism context, it's direct federal regulation, conditioned on waivers of fundamental rights like the right of a state not to be commandeered, are not to be judged by some deferential standard of rationality. They're subject to the most demanding scrutiny, if not per se unconstitutional. That principle is fully ripe here. And if their gambit works, the gambit that says there's an axe out there and it's going to fall and you may not like it, so you better get your act in order, if that gambit works, and if all 50 states then waive their right not to be treated as puppets of a federal ventriloquist, not to be commandeered, brought into the federal army, as it were, then look what happens.
Professor Trump, I'm still wondering how we manage that. I mean, we have facts here where the administrator has made some strong representations, mm-hmm. and you all are arguing we know what's coming. We know what's coming. But what do we do in the next case when someone comes along and says, there's a proposed rule, and we're confident it's going to be, the final rule is going to look just like it. So come and get involved.
Well, it really depends on whether there's any issue left open. You're very rarely going to have a case. I don't know of many in the past, and if we prevail here, there will be less in the future. I don't know of cases in which an agency says, we are making up our mind about the details, but our basic theory is that we have the right to regulate outside the statutory lines, mm-hmm. and we have the right to put states to this Hobson's choice. Either, on the one hand, you accept our commandeering, or we're going to bring some regulation, we won't tell you all of its details, down on you. You at that point know all you need to know to say that is impermissible. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's impermissible is not that those states that cave in can then come back and say, well, we were coerced, we haven't waived our rights. That's not so clear. I mean, the people who decided to plead guilty under the Lindbergh Law between 1934 and 1968, when they tried to come back into court, and they said, we want our life sentences to be vacated because those guilty pleas were coerced, they lost. These states are well counseled. They know what their choices are. And if you think you're going to have the opportunity to fully review the fundamental issue of whether this kind of Hobson's choice can be put to the states at a later stage, I'm not so sure, because the states that consent to go along with the EPA's plans are not going to be in the same position that they are now to say, wait a minute, what you're doing to us is a violation of our place in the scheme of the federal government as the Constitution contemplates it. So it seems to me that when that basic pattern is laid out, whether Ms. Burden is right or wrong, that there is a scintilla of a shred of ambiguity and whether that's enough, that all gets wiped away. And when she says there's no legislative history that supports our reading, well, we don't need it. But yes, there is, and she's wrong. In 1990, and this is in the briefs, the EPA testified before Congress that the compromise that was just suggested by the last speaker for the respondents, the compromise of saying that the EPA can regulate everything except the hazardous substances that are being regulated in these sources, she said that would be ridiculous. It would be ridiculous to have duplicative regulation even of different pollutants. And there's a perfectly good reason for it. You want to pressure the EPA to get its act together. If it's directly regulating the states, you don't want to encourage it to pass the bucks to the states. If it's directly regulating the industry under 112, you don't want to encourage it to say, well, we don't want to be accountable to either the people or to Congress. We're going to let the states do it and use 111D and hold this club over them. It seems to me that the fundamental issues are fully teed up. Yes, it's true that if we were saying, well, maybe it depends exactly what's in these regulations, whether they are too coercive or not. That's not what we're saying. If we were, you would then have to carve out a special principle for when you intervene. We're not saying that. And that this court has jurisdiction is clear. The question is, what does it write? And whatever remedy you do or do not provide, whatever your ultimate decree, I would urge you not to create or leave in place the illusion that an agency can simply make up the rules, something that UARG reminded us it cannot do under our system of government. Thank you.
Thank you.